You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica toku ingoa, no mai hari mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Caden. E whai aki nei coming up on the show. ACT MP Simon Court discussed ACT's proposal for primary industries, which they announced at the Field Days agricultural event over the weekend, as well as party leader David Seymour's comments comparing Palestine to Russia and China. I also spoke to Palestinian New Zealander and descendant of Palestinian refugees, Tamin Shaltoni and John Minto from the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa about Seymour's comments. Caden, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Kay from We Back Our Kaiako about their upcoming protest in support of teachers. I then spoke to Jack from Rainbow Path about the ramifications of the Human Rights Campaign's decision to declare a state of emergency for LGBTQ plus people in the United States.
And lastly, Nicholas spoke to Dr. Kelly Garton from the University of Auckland about their new study into free lunch programs in schools and their benefits. Hea hau whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rāne, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oe e wariwari, e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki eni kōrero ano hi pakihiri roki roki maurunga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho, mihaere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We Back Our Kaiako is a new student led group which has formed to support the teacher strikes. They're based in Te Whanganui Atara and will be protesting outside Parliament on Wednesday to show their support of the Post Primary Teachers Association. I spoke to their spokesperson Kay about why they've organised this protest and what their demands are.
Why have you organised this protest?
Seeing our kaiako come into class when they're burnt out, they're making ends meet, and they don't have time to do the things they care about, it's just heartbreaking as a student, and it also means that our education outcomes are kind of being dismantled because the government aren't giving the support needed to teachers to give us the support we need. So that's why we started this movement.
What do you hope this protest will achieve?
We hope that the government will see students out here fighting too and realise that it isn't just the teachers pushing the demands, because it doesn't just affect them, it affects everyone. So we hope the government will listen to the students if they're not going to listen to the teachers.
There's been a lot of anger from some parents about the teacher strikes because they're worried their kids are falling behind and being disrupted. In some cases, you know, they've had to take time off work to look after kids who aren't at school. What would your message be to those parents who are finding it difficult to support the teacher strikes?
Yes, it is quite a vocal minority of parents that don't support the teacher strike. However, the consequences that come from burnt out teachers are far greater than the impact of a couple of days off class at the moment. So for most parents of high school age students, their children will be 14 or over and should be able to stay home alone. It's really just those year 9s and some year 10s that haven't quite reached that age. And in that case, it's kind of a matter of, it's a couple of days now, but it's going to mean they'll have to stay at home for long amounts of time because there are no teachers in the future.
And are most of your peers at school supportive of the strikes? Are they going to be coming to this protest?
Yes, almost everyone that I've spoken to is supportive. Part regarding the turnout from my peers, it depends on how much schoolwork they have to catch up on. Because the Wednesday protest is on a year 9 and 13 rest at home day, it does mean that they're not going to be missing school to be able to attend it for the seniors and the very young juniors. However, there is still a lot of catch-up to be done because of the rest at home work that may mean some of them won't be able to go if they wanted to.
What would you tell people in terms of why should they turn up?
Turn up to secure your education. There are three things that we're asking the government to do as a result of our protest. The first one is fair compensation for the teachers. We demand our teachers receive fair and equitable compensation because of their qualifications, their experience and the crucial work they perform. Some teachers also have these cultural roles within the school that aren't acknowledged and aren't funded by the school. In addition to this, we want better working conditions for our kayako. So things like a reduction in the class size that current teachers endure, which kind of relates back to there being a shortage of teachers. At the moment, there are currently around 800 people in the country studying education, and in the school about 1,500. And there are 1,000 vacant teacher positions at the moment, which means classes are becoming bigger to be able to meet that shortage. In addition to this, we want teachers to be able to have the non-contact time they're requesting so that they can plan lessons, mark things, and get back to people one-on-one. And finally, we want an end to subject cuts at universities around the motu, because why would someone go into teaching if they can't study what they want to at university? So we want the government to make up the shortfall in funding to prevent the subject cuts.
That was high school student Kay from We Back Our Kayako on their upcoming protest. More info can be found on their Instagram at Back Our Kayako.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
At the Field Days Agriculture event over the weekend, ACT announced its policy for primary industries. ACT's plan for agricultural emissions would be introducing a split gas approach, separating methane and carbon dioxide when reporting emissions. I started off the interview asking why ACT would separate carbon dioxide and methane emissions in reporting.
Well, look, climate policy should be based on sound science. We need to acknowledge the fundamental differences between methane from livestock, which is a short-lived gas, and carbon dioxide, which is a long-lived gas. And so what ACT is saying is, look, we don't know enough yet about how much methane farms are actually taking out of the atmosphere, how much carbon dioxide they're taking out of the atmosphere by growing plants, by growing vegetation and crops. And so we need to know more about on-farm sequestration. And we also need to accept that New Zealand farmers are already amongst the most efficient in the world. They already pay for their carbon emissions through the emissions trading scheme for all the fuel that they use, all the energy that they use. And ACT says give farmers a fair go and base climate policies on sound science.
But we know that methane makes up around 71% of New Zealand's agricultural emissions and has more warming power than carbon dioxide. But ACT has said that if New Zealand's trading partners aren't paying a price for their methane emissions, that New Zealand farmers shouldn't. But do you think we could be missing an opportunity for Aotearoa to be a world leader in climate change?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the Paris Climate Accord specifically excluded food production from emissions pricing because it recognised that increasing the cost of food, whether it's to communities in New Zealand or anywhere else in the world, is fundamentally at odds with improving society and making progress when it comes to human civilization. Food's already expensive enough without adding a whole lot of emissions charges to it. That's why it was excluded. Now, if we think about the opportunity for New Zealand, I have heard some comments that large buyers of bulk milk products might say, look, we're not going to buy milk or protein from countries that don't manage their emissions down. And ACT would say, fair enough. If Nestle, for example, says to Fonterra, we're not buying your milk unless you can show us that your farmers achieve a zero carbon or a zero emissions profile by a certain date, of course, you know, that's what customers and suppliers are free to negotiate on. But that doesn't mean the New Zealand government should be putting a price on agricultural emissions. That should be up to the individual businesses that want to negotiate that with their customers. And then we think about what this opportunity is for New Zealand. To lead where? By putting a price on agricultural emissions when no one else is doing it, that would only reduce our ability to compete internationally. And most likely, that farm production would leave New Zealand and just go to another country where they don't price emissions. So it wouldn't help control global greenhouse gas emissions. It would just make New Zealand poorer.
So you've mentioned that it should be up to the market and not the government to regulate, essentially, our emissions. And you've proposed scrapping the Zero Carbon Act. So why are you opposed to having a system in place towards reducing or a target for reducing carbon emissions?
Our ACT is not opposed to having a target to reduce emissions. In fact, ACT thinks that if New Zealand wants to adopt the target like zero net carbon by 2050, that's probably an appropriate goal. The problem with the Zero Carbon Act, it doesn't just set a target, set a cap on emissions, and then allow New Zealand businesses and consumers to trade freely under a cap. I mean, that's what the emissions trading scheme was supposed to do. What the Zero Carbon Act does is allow the government to intervene and interfere in any sector of the economy based on its ideology around whether they think cows are bad, or in the case of the now deposed or stood down transport minister, that cars are bad and we should reduce private motor vehicle trips by 20% by 2035. None of these additional policies actually help New Zealand meet its emissions targets. And you just take even the clean car discount, which has been taxing people who have to buy vans, large vehicles, utes, and handing that money over to people who are already wealthy enough to afford the $72,000 out of the $80,000 cost for a Tesla. Now, whether you think that's a good use of taxpayer money or not is kind of irrelevant. It doesn't change the fact that New Zealand has a cap on emissions, and any trading or reductions under that cap don't change New Zealand's overall emissions. Zach would say we just need a really simple policy, set a cap on emissions, set the target, government, regulate the market, making sure that people aren't ripping each other off in the emissions trading scheme, and stand back and get out of the way.
ACT has also proposed getting rid of the Climate Change Commission. Where would you propose that the government get their climate advice from without the commission?
Well, I think the problem with the Climate Change Commission is that their advice has always been highly politicised and ideological. I mean, the Climate Change Commission refuses to give advice to the government on carbon capture and storage technology. The impression I get from having spoken to commissioners is that they'd rather not encourage people to keep producing or using carbon. And so it just ignores the fact that New Zealand does produce and use carbon, and we will be indefinitely, you know, whether it's the carbon fiber that we use to make rockets that rocket labs send into space with satellites, you know, whether it's the carbon that we use that's produced from coking coal, which is excavated from the west coast of the South Island, some of the most pure carbon-based minerals found anywhere in the world. That goes into all kinds of things, plastics, paints, resins, glues, you know, the plastic surrounding on your cell phone, for example. So we'll always use carbon. And what ACT says is, look, it's much simpler to say, let the market set a price on carbon. At the moment, under the emissions trading scheme, it's currently around $50, $54 a tonne. And businesses that have an obligation to pay that price have a very clear incentive to reduce their emissions. That's pretty much the end of the conversation. And with that sinking lid on carbon emissions out to 2050, we've agreed we'll get to net zero, hands off government. We don't need advice from the climate change. Businesses are already doing this stuff.
Is ACT going to be prioritising farmers over the climate this election?
Well, ACT actually wants to prioritise the well-being of all New Zealanders, but farmers are a group that have had a really unfortunate focus. They've had a target put on them by this current government, by both Labor and the Greens, and they've been blamed for pollution of waterways, pollution of the atmosphere. What's not recognised is that farming production has got more and more efficient over the past few decades. We've actually got far fewer animals on the land, producing a much higher quantity and value of very high quality protein. And at the same time, farmers are just asking for the technologies that are available anywhere else in the world to reduce emissions, like genetically modified ryegrass, for example, that when the animals eat it, they produce a lot less methane. Or, hey, instead of central government, the Ministry for Environment, saying what the water quality should be in a in a muddy river in Northland, and hey, that's the same number that MFE want to apply to a beautiful, clear, braided river in the South Island. What ACT would say is, why not let the regions determine what their water quality objectives are and manage nutrient discharges and water allocation accordingly? We can do that through market mechanisms. That's what they do in Australia. ACT says there's a whole lot of simple stuff we could do that rewards and acknowledges the place that farmers have in our community, in our economy, without targeting them for a whole lot of heavy-handed regulation.
ACT Party leader David Seymour also made comments comparing Palestine's right to defend itself against Israel with China's treatment of Uyghurs and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. These comments came after pro-Kremlin edits were found in RNZ's coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I asked Court about these comments and why ACT has taken a stance against Palestine. So Seymour has accused RNZ of propaganda and Palestinian-friendly framing. Why did ACT decide to make this statement?
Well, for a state broadcaster to publish material that includes Russian, Palestinian and Chinese propaganda is appalling. New Zealanders should be able to trust their state broadcaster to be totally and utterly impartial. And if you look at some of the changes made by individual rogue staff at Radio New Zealand, and we're talking about changes to articles written by Reuters journalists who are on the ground in the Middle East, for example, when it comes to reporting on that terrorist organisation, Hamas, Islamic Jihad and Fatah, they've changed it from militant groups at Radio New Zealand head office, militant groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad and Fatah, to resistance groups. Now, these organisations are regularly firing rockets into Israel. They're kidnapping civilians. They're executing people in cold blood. There hasn't been an election in the Palestinian territories for well over a decade. These are dictatorships and terrorist dictatorships. And for Radio New Zealand journalists to be essentially whitewashing that by adding their own political interpretation of Reuters journalists on the ground reports is completely unacceptable.
Israel's occupation of the West Bank has been condemned by human rights organisations and it goes against international law. Does ACT recognise that Israel's actions are illegal?
ACT certainly recognises that Israel has a right to exist and that there has been a two-state solution on the table for many, many years. The problem is, how do you negotiate with people who actually, and when you're thinking about those organisations that govern Gaza, for example, Hamas, or the Palestinian Authority that governs the West Bank, how do you negotiate with people a two-state solution when those organisations are facilitating and even paying people, family members, who are committing terrorist acts? So you know, what ACT says is that everybody has the right to live in dignity, the right to freedom, to choose to elect their own government, and ACT would definitely want to support that aspiration for the Palestinian people. But what we don't support is Radio New Zealand journalists adding their own political flavour and essentially making stuff up, when we should be able to trust Radio New Zealand as the state broadcaster, that the information they're sending us, particularly when they're telling us it comes from a Reuters journalist on the ground, is actually what that Reuters journalist wrote. And that's the point that David Seymour was making.
Why has ACT chosen to compare Palestine with China and Russia, who have both, in their cases, been aggressors against minority groups in smaller countries? Do you really believe that they're the same?
We're not trying to establish moral equivalence here. I mean, we're talking about Radio New Zealand reporting on organisations that have committed atrocities against civilians. I mean, we know that China is carrying out some kind of genocide or cultural genocide against the Uyghur Muslim people in Xinjiang. I mean, we do know that Russia has invaded Ukraine and is doing terrible things to civilians, including taking them away and putting them in camps in Russia. And what we also know is that there are organisations that are running the Palestinian territories. We're talking about the terrorist organisation, globally sanctioned terrorist organisation Hamas, which has regularly tried to kidnap Israeli civilians and soldiers and hold them in terrible conditions and torture them. And And there is no moral equivalence between what those organisations and countries do and a country like Israel, which has a democratic government. Now, you know, just like in New Zealand, we elect a government every 3 years. Not everybody likes it, but, you know, every on a regular basis, you have a chance to vote them out. And, you know, I think we need to respect the wishes of the Israeli people when it comes to the government that they choose, even though we might not like all the political parties or we might not like their policies. They're democratically elected. And I think any moral equivalence between a democratically elected country and organisations that essentially are practising terrorism or genocide against populations is just silly.
Does ACT recognise that Seymour's comments have upset the Palestinian community here in Aotearoa?
Well, I don't think it's helpful to generalise a group of people in that way. I mean, I'm sure that there are widely differing views amongst people in the Palestinian community about the behaviour of their governing organisations like Hamas and Fatah and the Palestinian occupied territories. But, you know, what we're really trying to point out here is that New Zealanders have a right to expect truthful reporting from our state broadcaster that is totally and utterly impartial. And so, you know, whether something that David Seymour has said upsets a group of people in New Zealand who have political views, I mean, that's one of the things that ACT regularly does. We say things that are difficult for people. We take on the difficult subjects and we don't resolve from that.
That was ACT MP Simon Court discussing their views on farming and agriculture emissions as well as Palestine.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
To celebrate the hard mahi volunteers put into selflessly serving their communities, MOTAT wants to treat all volunteers to free entry.
Simply head to MOTAT between the 17th and the 25th of June with some proof of your volunteer work and enjoy what MOTAT has to offer on the house.
Come and celebrate National Volunteer Week with MOTAT.
From the 17th to the 25th of June from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Find out more at motat.nz.
Hey, Captain, do you think we'll ever find the land of the good groove?
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's just, we've been floating on this dinghy for months, since the crew mutiny.
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's concerning that you keep repeating that. I don't even think my name is Sonny Jim. Is that my name? Captain.
Patience, Captain. Sonny Jim.
I am Sonny Jim. We are both Sonny Jim. Lando, we made it. Let's drink some more seawater to celebrate.
Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamek. Bringing a solid hour of funk, electricity and soul to your Friday afternoons. It's time to move, time to get loose, anywhere you are. Land of the Good Groove, 1 till 2 p.m. every Friday, right here on 95 BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
ACT Party leader David Seymour has accused RNZ of propaganda and Palestinian-friendly framing. These comments came after pro-Kremlin edits were found in RNZ's coverage of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I spoke to Palestinian New Zealander and descendant of Palestinian refugees, Tamim Sheltoni. Firstly, I asked for some background into Israel's unlawful occupation of the West Bank.
David Seymour's comment is just one part of it. But if we step back, there's a big news this week about the RNZ edits or corrections. So I just need to put things into perspective. There are two aspects to the news that I would like to talk about. The first aspect is political, and this is coming from the Palestinian cause, and obviously it's heavily politicized. Palestine under military occupation for 75 years. Palestinians are being dispossessed. My own grandparents were expelled from their homes in 1948. My dad himself was literally born on the way to relative safety, and my mom was born in a refugee camp in Damascus, Syria. And Palestinians who still live in Palestine as of today, they live under cruel occupation and apartheid that has been described even by South Africans that it is worse than what they saw in back in apartheid South Africa. It is settler colonialism. It happened in other places, happened here in New Zealand, happened in Australia, Canada, and other places. So it's not something new. So to suggest that Palestinians who have been living under these conditions for 75 years somehow have an effective propaganda machine similar to what you expect from the global powers, and to be able to manipulate and use in New Zealand in the corner of the world is just absurd, right? It's sad and laughable at the same time. It's ahistorical, silly, and it's actually offending to put it on par or to put us on par with China's treatment of Uyghurs or Russian invasion to Ukraine in the way that David Seymour put it. I also find it ironic that someone would denounce disinformation and in the same statement spreads disinformation in that way. So it's really wrong. It shouldn't have been that way. So now if we go back to where I started with the two aspects of the news, the first one was the political. The second aspect, and this is very important for us as a community here in New Zealand, is a social aspect, is social level. We are just normal people, right? We are everyday New Zealanders. Our children, they go to school that yours go to. We live in a neighborhood next to you. We have jobs and we work alongside with you and other people. Many of us are politically active or engaged, but at the same time, many of us are not. They're just normal people living their life, right, and identify as Palestinian. So every time the word Palestine or Palestinian is mentioned in the news, especially in a negative framing, it affects us tangibly at a personal level. We get hated on verbally, on social media, and even physically. People think of us as some sort of terrorists or something, and it affects our lives. It affects our jobs, our children at school, and our overall sense of belonging to society. It affects our job or our life opportunities, our experience in life, and it excludes us from the society more than what we already marginalized. Because keep in mind, most of us are migrants or refugees, and many of us are Muslim. So being Palestinian and having that experience of exclusion is just another layer on top of that. So we really expect better from people in politics and media to protect us from that hate and unnecessary exclusion factors, because you know we have enough of that on our plate as a community. So hence it's the outrage from the community against Seymour's statement. We know it's election year. Parties and political figures, they want to attack each other. We understand this, but we don't want to be or to become someone's political football. Just keep our community out of it.
Then I asked about why David Seymour's comments are concerning to the Palestinian community.
I touched upon the propaganda. I think that is completely inappropriate and even inaccurate. The other one is he said the news were edited to become Palestine-friendly. This is nonsense. So I have been monitoring Palestine-related news on all of the New Zealand news and media outlets or platforms for the last 2 years. And I can tell you, we've got a massive problem here as far as Palestine is concerned. First, the news about Palestine that come on or appear on New Zealand-based outlets, they are very rare compared to the ongoing daily Israeli state violence against Palestinians. Just last week, the Israeli army shot a three-year-old Palestinian boy in the head, a toddler, you know. He lost his life, sadly. There was nothing about it in the news in New Zealand at all, nothing. Every day I was checking if there's anything about it, there was nothing. So this is what we're dealing with. There's already censorship in about Palestine in the New Zealand news. And people, they don't know about the truth. So that is the first factor or the first point about the comments from David Seymour. The other one is even when there's a news about Palestine that is usually coming through the wire news This is what comes from Reuters, CNN, AP, or BBC. We know these outlets are absorbed in U.S. imperialism, and the U.S. is the single most backend enabler to Israel. And naturally, the news coming through those channels, they reflect the U.S. bias against Palestinians. As an example, when you read any Palestinian-related news on Reuters or AP, you will become more confused when you finish reading, because it doesn't tell you what is the big picture. It just tells you about discrete events from angry people here and there, escalated into clashes, then just ended suddenly without a clear explanation. So it leaves you more confused. It doesn't give you that broader context. It doesn't tell you about apartheid. It doesn't tell you why these events happen on a daily basis. When you read this news, it doesn't give you the big picture. It doesn't explain to you the broader context, and it leaves you more confused than before. In fact, I checked my records, and I had a complaint submitted to RNZ earlier this year on one of the articles in a question. That was after the edits or corrections, right? So they're not Palestine-friendly at all. Then if we look at the edits that were in question, like one of them was a piece of news that came from Reuters that was following the election in Israel, and it said the new government is hard right or something. It was edited here on RNZ to say far right instead of hard right. So I don't know what's the difference between hard and far. Does it make any change or does it make any difference? Now, I'm not advocating for these edits, but I'm saying to put them into perspective, they're nothing. They mean nothing, and they don't change the narrative, and they don't look Palestine-friendly at all. So that is just complete nonsense. I think it's just part of the political game right now because of the election.
Lastly, I asked Sheltoni for his message to the media and political figures.
I mean, I've been thinking about this, and I have a message just mainly to the media and the news outlets and agencies in New Zealand, because this is now the hot topic, right? So I thought I will address them with what really as a community expect or where I would like to see them going. The first and utmost point is I would really like them to talk to the community here, the local community, to get local listening voices and perspective on the Palestine-related news. Now, this is not controversial, right? It's basic journalism being balanced and to offer different perspectives, especially from those who are impacted directly by the news that you're publishing. Another point is I would really like our news or our media agencies to use sources for wire news on Palestine that are not part of the problem, they are part of the problem because they just repeat the Israeli propaganda lines that are coming literally from the Israeli army spokespersons. So we would like to use other sources, and we'd like them to talk to Palestinians and offer just countering perspectives. We also want them to cover the broader context. So it's not just reporting on the events that happen on a daily basis, but just put it in a wider or broader context, to help us spread the word and tell our stories and educate people about what's going on in Palestine. I appreciate maybe it's hard to put for the media to put reporters in every single country, but maybe once in a while they can send someone over to Palestine. They can see in their eyes, and they can report back directly to our New Zealand public and readers.
I also heard from John Minto from the Palestine Solidarity Network, Aotearoa, about his criticism of New Zealand and other Western media's coverage of Israel's occupation of the West Bank. What was your reaction to Seymour's comments?
They were done thoughtlessly, with a background of prejudice, which is deeply, deeply insulting to the people of Palestine. I mean, in Palestine, it's the Palestinians who are the victims, they are the oppressed people. And here they are being demonised by the ACT Party leader. It's simply not on.
And Seymour's comments came after pro-Kremlin edits were found in RNZ's coverage. And Seymour claimed that RNZ's edits are pro-Palestine. So in your opinion, does RNZ and other media in Aotearoa accurately report on Israel's treatment of Palestine?
No, they don't. Our media are simply awful in their reporting of what goes on in the Middle East, and they leave people confused, and people just shake their heads and say, oh, they're all bad, they're all at each other's throats. And that's the way Israel wants it to be. They want people to be confused. What the media don't do is they don't explain or record the fact that Palestine is occupied by Israel. Israeli troops occupy and control every aspect of Palestinian lives. They don't report the racist laws which discriminate against Palestinians in every aspect of their lives, just like it did for people in South Africa under the old apartheid regime there. So we don't get that. We get a Western Eurocentric view of the world, Eurocentric view of the Middle East, which doesn't equate with the fact.
Can you give some examples of anti-Palestine bias in reporting from RNZ or other media outlets?
Well, there are some very simple biases that are built in. They're hardwired into how the reporting is done. For example, whenever Palestinians resist the occupation, which they have a right to do under international law, they have a right to armed struggle under international law. But when they do that, our media refers to them as militants or terrorists. In fact, they are resistance fighters. They are resisting a military occupation of their country. And they should be given that basic respect by Radio New Zealand and other media. And we have a similar kind of situation where in simply describing the area, our media talk about the West Bank, about Gaza, and about East Jerusalem. What they should say is it is occupied East Jerusalem. It is occupied West Bank. It is the occupied Gaza Strip. In other words, the Israeli military occupy everything. So we should be talking about the occupation. But the media, very occasionally a story will get through that talks about the occupation of those areas, but it's done as a sideline. It should be hard-baked into all of their reporting because that reflects the accuracy of the situation on the ground.
In your opinion, how do we end up with this very Eurocentric view of what's happening in Palestine?
Simply because it is in the interests of the West and of the US in particular to maintain Israel's occupation of Palestine, because right from the beginning, the only interest the West had was not in supporting Jews or Jewish aspirations to a homeland. Nothing of the sort. What they wanted was a beachhead in the Middle East, which is where at that small fact, right through the century and even today, there are huge oil reserves. And America wanted to, not because America needs the oil itself, but it wants to control the flow of oil to its friends and away from its enemies. So they wanted Israel there to police the Middle East on their behalf. And that is at the heart of the problem.
And some claim that critique of Israel or pro-Palestine coverage is anti-Semitic. What do you say to these sorts of claims?
Well, I say they're absolute rubbish. What Israel's strategy is to do is to create a massive amount of confusion so that people don't understand and don't engage with the issue. But secondly, anyone who does gets whacked with a false smear of anti-Semitism. And these are people, the pro-Israeli lobby here in New Zealand and around the world, they would find anti-Semitism in the words "the" and if it was all they had to go on. They throw around these smears like confetti. And unfortunately for politicians and for editors and people in prominent positions in the media, they are susceptible to these false smears of anti-Semitism. They just have to grow a little bit of integrity and face these people down.
Why do you believe that people are more willingly able to call out Russia's treatment of Ukraine and not Israel's treatment of Palestine?
Well, that's a really good question because our government did speak out very strongly against the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that was right. I mean, it was a breach of international law. They should never have invaded Ukraine. But you have to understand the reasons why it happened. And we call out Russia, but we're not calling out Israel. And that's the problem. Israel is getting away with blue murder in Palestine against Palestinians. And the Western world is just turns their back and shrugs their shoulders. Whereas if the victims are blue-eyed Europeans, our media and our politicians take note. But if they're brown people, if they're not from, you know, with a European background, then we're just not interested. And that's a tragedy, because human rights should be applied equally to everyone anywhere in the world.
What would you like to see from RNZ and other media going forward when reporting on the Middle East and Israel and Palestine?
Well, what we'd like them to do is to report on the basis of international law, United Nations resolutions, and, in fact, the policy of the New Zealand government. Instead, what Radio New Zealand does is it takes these reports from overseas, particularly BBC reports, which are appalling in the way they describe Palestinians. They take these BBC reports and just put them on their website and use them as for their daily news bulletins, rather than going back and looking at what is the status of the situation in terms of international law, United Nations resolutions, the International Court of Justice. What are all these international institutions saying about the Middle East? We should line up how we describe the situation as it would be described under international law.
And that was John Minto from the Palestine Solidarity Network, Aotearoa, about his criticism of Western media's coverage of Palestine.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
The government's Ka Ora Ka Ako Healthy School Lunches program began in 2019 in an effort to reduce food insecurity for New Zealand children. The program has now been extended to 22,000 students at 989 schools across the motu. The findings of a recent study into its impact has prompted a petition seeking further government funding to expand the program. Nicholas spoke to the lead author of the study, Dr. Kelly Garten, about why more students would benefit from the program.
The idea behind the study was to review what the Ka Ora Ka Ako program has achieved so far in the limited time it's been running, and to see what impact it could potentially have in the long term with continued investment and scaling up. So to collect the data, we started by consulting in depth with stakeholders from the Ministry of Education who developed the program and those actually implementing it in schools, to develop a theoretical model of the program's outcomes and impacts at different levels.
Excellent.
So these levels are based on what we call a social ecological model or theory of health, where we recognize that an individual, in this case the child or learner, is really nested within multiple different social layers with factors influencing their health. So that includes their whānau, their solar community, and the wider food system. So impacts, you know, at any of these levels will have ripple effects throughout the other levels of impact as well. So once we had this model put together, we combined findings from existing program evaluations and smaller studies of Ka Ora Ka Ako with international studies, longer running universal school food programs. So these were, for example, in Sweden, in Scotland, the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. So we're able to get a fuller picture of what a program like Ka Ora Ka Ako could achieve in the long term if it continues to be invested in.
Excellent. And what were some of the key findings of your study?
Yeah, so basically, evaluations that had already been done domestically have found that participating children were reporting less hunger at school, improved mental and physical well-being overall. Parents and caregivers were experiencing less financial and time stress. And other local studies reported principals noticing calmer classroom environments in the afternoon, so an environment more conducive to learning. So that was the domestic evidence. But the international evidence indicated that school lunch programs can actually further enrich school environments with particular links to the curriculum, so curriculum enhancement. They can help boost local economies through job creation, they can enhance the availability and affordability of healthy foods through kind of driving increased demand and also encouraging innovations, things like sustainable packaging and reformulation of healthier products in the market.
Yeah, and I read in the study some of the other outstanding elements that you guys mentioned. And you talked about before the provision of highly nutritious foods and increasing that demand, but also reducing hunger and benefits in physical education as well. And another interesting suggestion of the study was that it should be expanded to not just cover lower socioeconomic areas. What implications does expansion have, and why is it necessary that every child in New Zealand is part of this program?
Well, so right now, as you know, it's only applied to the lowest 25% of schools based on the equity index. But we know that there are still quite a few children with home food insecurity in the mid and high equity index schools, which right now are not eligible for the program. So really important that this program be scaled up to reach all of those children in need. But regardless of home, you know, food insecurity status, this program does have further benefits to all children, including their families and schools and communities. So really, we could be experiencing much greater benefits, to the communities at large and to the food system through scaling up this program. It is a large investment, but the research indicates that the dividends will be huge.
That was Dr. Kelly Garten on the impact of the Ka Ora Ka Ako Healthy School Lunches program and the petition to expand it.
The Human Rights Campaign, the largest LGBTQ advocacy organisation in the United States, has declared its first national state of emergency. They've cited the proliferation of legislation in state houses across the country aimed at regulating the lives of queer people as the reasoning behind this move. I spoke to Jack from Rainbow Path about the impact of legislation like this on Aotearoa and why it's so important we support LGBTQ plus asylum seekers and organisations which advocate for human rights. I started by asking, when countries like the United States seemingly go backwards or make queer people targets at an exponential rate, should that be alarming for queer people in Aotearoa?
On a really practical level, when you see a backlash in any other country, it does impact on people here in Aotearoa. A lot of the backlash currently from the US that you mentioned is against trans people, and you can see on online forum and within the community that it highlights the level of vulnerability of the community. And that's also because people know that some of the misinformation that happens here in Aotearoa comes from overseas. There are some direct links between misinformation and disinformation that fuels a backlash in the US and the experiences of trans people here. You don't have to look very far to see US speakers, US fact sheets, other US so-called research appearing on websites or in interviews with groups campaigning against the rights of trans people here in Aotearoa.
Do you think Aotearoa's laws are up to scratch to protect people from having their rights taken away?
If you think of the rights of rainbow people in general here in Aotearoa, even then it's important to make distinctions. Like, it's clear that sexual orientation is a protected ground of discrimination in the Human Rights Act. While the Human Rights Commission has always said that trans and intersex people are protected under the ground of sex, the backlashes internationally have questioned the extent of that protection. And there's been an absence of guidance from government agencies, schools, workplaces often, about actually what it means that trans and intersex people are also protected under the Human Rights Act here. So unfortunately, even though there is protection, there hasn't been guidance that means that people actually know and feel that they are protected, and a significant proportion of trans people don't feel that all trans people are protected under the Human Rights Act and don't feel that they would personally be protected if they were discriminated against. Many of the rights that rainbow people have here aren't necessarily available to someone who comes here and is on a temporary visa because they've come as an asylum seeker or they're a convention refugee. You can't even change your name in New Zealand until you're a resident. And often people aren't aware that, you know, someone who is here as a refugee has the right to health, has the right to access public health services. So I think while we haven't had yet legal backlash, the removal of existing rights, we have for quite a while now had the questioning of what those rights mean for people, and people fear that that may have an impact on them being able to access services, especially when there's already a gap in being able to access them.
Is New Zealand a safe place for trans and intersex refugees?
A tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of rainbow refugees, including trans and intersex people, who are fleeing persecution in their own countries, ever manage to leave. The vast majority will never be able to leave their countries. So the most important thing that any of us can do is support rainbow groups in those countries overseas to stand up for their rights, to fight for those rights, and just to support each other on the ground, because most people will be staying there, or if they manage to flee somewhere, it'll be to a slightly safer place in their own country or a slightly safer place just across the border. New Zealand accepts very, very few refugees compared to many other countries around the world, and rainbow people are less likely to be able to get here. They're less likely to be able to travel, to have documents that mean that they can travel safely here. They're less likely to be able to feel safe to tell a refugee agency overseas that they need to get, that they're under attack. They're less likely to feel safe if they're in a refugee camp or if they're hiding in the community somewhere. So the first message is that if we want to support people in other countries, support the communities in those countries, whether it's Uganda, Kenya, who are standing up for their rights, and also support the activists fighting against the backlash, because that helps prevent it having a negative impact on us as well. And be in solidarity with the other groups. Trans and rainbow people aren't the only groups under attack in the US right now. There's attacks on sexual and reproductive rights. The thing that makes it easy for a political backlash is when there is fear and misinformation in the community, and so the wider community believes the politicians and thinks somehow that there's a moral panic and that... And blames and scapegoats, trans people, rainbow people, and other groups. You know, we see it happening to migrants, to immigrants, to refugees, to Māori, to Pacific people, to black people in the US. Like that scapegoating of a community for political gain happens all around the world. And then we get to really practical things like your question about, okay, if someone is one of the few people who manages to come here as a trans or intersex asylum seeker or refugee, is it safe here? When someone first makes contact with Rainbow Path, when they arrive here, the first thing we say to someone is, you are safe. You are safe. And that's because if something happened to them while they were here, we probably would be able to make a complaint. We could probably, you know, try and wrap some love and support around them. They are not fleeing for their life in the way that they have had to flee from persecution overseas. But apart from that, we can't say, look, there's all this support for you here, because there isn't. It is very, very difficult, especially when people come as an asylum seeker. There are huge gaps in support available for asylum seekers, convention refugees, and also quota refugees who come here. So all of those people who are concerned about the awful plight of so many rainbow people around the world, you know, Rainbow Path always will say, try and support people in their country of origin. And yes, we need to come together as rainbow communities and wider communities here to actually make it not just safe, once someone gets here, but actually livable, sustainable for someone once they're here. I was recently listening to presentations from Rainbow People from the Ukraine, and in that they talked about in the midst of fighting there that they are they're organising not only for Rainbow People in their country, but they've created places that people can come together for other people who are displaced, have lost families, who didn't have access to food. I would love to see that Aotearoa finds a way to, you know, that people come together and push back against the misinformation that's coming from the US and that is feeding campaigns against trans people here right now. And we just say, look, we don't need that sort of negative attitudes. We're a different sort of country. And that too becomes a beacon of hope to other people who get a sense that it's not inevitable. Right-wing politicians doing campaigns based on populist fear and misinformation, if we can stand up to that, we can show that actually when people care about the Rainbow People in their families, people care about the Rainbow People in their schools, the Rainbow People in their workplaces, and when someone starts repeating the misinformation that's coming from overseas, including the US, if people can just go, did you check the source? Are you sure about that? How would you feel if that was your child? And things like that. I think some of that is equally as important as, of course, standing up for better legal protections.
That was Jack from Rainbow Path about LGBTQ+ rights in the context of the recent Human Rights Campaign Declaration of Emergency for Queer People in the United States.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.